is that this, the speech arts, the idea of debate, the idea of developing the art of listening critically, the idea of discussing issues and having public forums is as important a part of a theater or auditorium as plays and concerts, and sometimes that idea is missed, I think. Now, I've taken quite a long while there, and I'll introduce another speaker. I'd like Carmen Gentile from Kenai to give you some ideas on it.
My name is Carmen Gentile. I'm from Kenai, representing the Kenai Arts and Humanities Council. Thank you for the opportunity. I'd like to speak in favor of the legislation. The city of Kenai is proposing a facility which will house theater for the performing arts, cultural museums, art and historical, and a community convention center, which the city's in dire need of. The support that I can offer to you from the community came by the voters who voted to support, maintain, and operate this facility at a cost. The amounts published at the time were $150,000 a year. The people of the city of Kenai voted that they would support that if the state funded the project with the construction dollars. The maintenance and operations schedule, which has just recently been completed, indicate that those costs are in that area of $150,000 per year. The city council, by resolution, approved the concept of the facility and supported the project. They have set aside property for the project valued at $250,000 for the construction of this project. The council again last Wednesday night on March 14th reaffirmed its commitment to this facility. The need for the facility I'll address briefly. The attendance records over the past 5 years have indicated approximately 18% per year increase over the past 5 year in attendance in cultural theater for the performing arts facilities, plays, concerts, etc. Currently, over those 5 years, they were held in the Kenai High School Gymnasium. The importance of these facilities statewide, I'm sure you all agree, that one of the main thing everyone in Alaska would like to see now is more business and industry coming here. And I think to get business and industry to come to Alaska, we have to improve the quality of life. And I think cultural facilities are one way of doing that, a very important way. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Yes, sir. How do you feel, and you probably have a better vote, I don't know how they voted, how they voted, but how would they feel? We just passed a bill out of finance a while ago for giving $1,000 per capita for capital projects within their community. What's the population of Kenai?
The city of Kenai is 4,500 people.
So you're going to get $4,500,000. What would be your judgment as to how willing they would be to spend some of that? Where would that fit in their sense of priorities, you know, considering that we just have so many bucks to go around on capital improvement?
Again, I can only revert to the fact, Senator, that they have voted support, and I'm sure if the city of Kenai would receive $4.5 million, that a good percentage of that would be spent on the cultural facility.
If I could say one sentence in answer to your question. Petersburg has prioritized their cultural facility with their hospital as number one. If that kind of funding came through that you're talking about, it would be roughly one-fourth of the total need for those two projects.
Well, you could list a number of things in Petersburg that can be done and say that this is only a portion. I'll ask you the same question. Out of these grant funds, if we could have projects in Petersburg, would you be willing to spend any of those dollars for conference?
The council has indicated by vote that the cultural facility is tied with first place on a prioritizing basis with the hospital, so I would have to answer affirmatively.
May I make one more point,
yes,
sir? That although the city of Kenai population is 4,500, the area that will be served by this cultural facility is approximately 10 to 12,000 people. That's from Nikiski to Sterling down to Anchor Point. That entire area will be available, have this facility available to them. Thank you.
I'd like to introduce Sue Dreidoppel from Bethel.
Good
brought some things with me. I'm Susan Dreadoffel from Bethel. I'm the curator of the Yuktal Hervik Regional Museum out there. Many of you probably know of the museum. Many of you may have visited the museum. You probably know of the tragic fire at the museum last June. About a quarter of our artifacts were destroyed. Another quarter were seriously damaged, and things like that. I brought a few things with me just to show you what can happen to some of the treasures in the state. This was a picture that was taken before the fire. None of the park is in it exists anymore. This is all that's left of one of the parkas here. This was a child seal gut parka. It was not anywhere near the flames. That's just what happens. The artifacts in this state are vulnerable, they're fragile, and they should be cared for. I can pass this around if you'd like to take a better look. Many of the communities involved in the cultural facilities want to include a place in their building for a museum or to store some of their cultural heritage. There are many artifacts in the state that are reminders of Alaska's history and our heritage. Some of them are in museums. Some of them are in houses or on back porches or in sheds. Some of them are outside of the state. There are a lot in the Smithsonian, which a lot of people would like to get back, including our First Lady. And this type of thing could happen to any of those things that are in the state. They are unprotected. They're also vulnerable not only to fire, but to things like fading, deterioration because of weather, leaky roofs, neglect, things like that. What we need are buildings, properly constructed buildings, to house these items and to preserve them for future residents of the state. It is entirely proper, I feel, that the state should be involved with the preservation of these artifacts because it is, after all, the state's heritage that we're preserving. We are providing you with a mechanism to do this through the support of the cultural facilities. Many of your communities have a museum or historical society, or many of you probably have private collections of artifacts, things like that, that you are hoping to save maybe for your children or your grandchildren or for posterity. They're vulnerable too, no matter how well-intentioned you are. Fire is a big hazard in Alaska. It's happened to a former member of this legislative body last year, even though he didn't plan on it. And we're asking you to think for a minute what those things would look like after they'd been through a fire. And after you think of that, before we lose any more, we'd like you to please support cultural facilities.
If there are no questions, I'd like to introduce George Cruz from Kodiak.
Good morning. It's nice to be with you. My name's George Cruz. I'm the executive director of the Kodiak Area Chamber of Commerce. I think that it's important for you to realize that those of us who are here on the Cultural Facilities Development Committee are not a bunch of artsy, craftsy kooks, but a finely interested group of Alaskans who are smart enough to realize the tremendous economic impact these community facilities will have on each of our towns, and therefore on the entire state. Now, we've been patiently waiting and educating our own communities as well as our legislators about what these facilities will mean to us. And I guess we're going to continue to wait because we know, and what we know is that these facilities will be an economic bonanza for the entire state. For example, in Saxman, they're planning a native community longhouse, a real fine tourist attraction. Tourists spend money. In Kenai and Kodiak, the facilities, will, among other things, will enable us to hold conventions, seminars, etc. Conventioners spend money. But more important than these obvious benefits is that the facilities will mean better living for all of us. We know, and recent surveys have backed this up, that the most important factor in attracting new business and improving economic well-being is not roads, services, utility rates, etc., but the quality of life of the community. If our cities are good places to live, offer family activities, business will come. And this is exactly what we're all about, direct, not indirect, but direct economic development. Passage of this bill will be a great investment in the future of Alaska that will pay for itself in the years to come. Thank you.
Any questions?
I heard commitment from Kenai that if theirs were to pass, that they would maintain. So, how do you feel about Kodiak? Got any commitment that you own?
We have not, in Kodiak, have not submitted the vote the Kenai people did to our people yet. However, we have a very fine indication that if it would, it would pass. In fact, we know it would. We passed the Proposition E last fall along with the rest of all the communities here that are represented today, even though it did not pass on the statewide basis. But we passed it 60% in Kodiak, and if we can do it in Kodiak, we know that it'll fly.
Mr. Chairman, I was impressed with Kenai's statement that they had at least gone and public input that they would pick up the operating cost. Back to a debate that we've had and we'll continue to have, I guess, until this session's over, about the operating cost is going to continue on without any input from those communities. And that's why I'm asking the question. It's spot on that, but I've just kind of decided that any time we make decisions for local communities, we ought to get as much input from those people, particularly if they have to pick up the bills and pay off for all this, that we ought to be consulting. So, if for any reason you don't get everything you want, I would suggest to anybody come to the Finance Committee, the future would be helpful if we knew what the local community had some feeling in the way that we're doing.
Well, Senator McGee,
go ahead.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, if I might inject, the Act itself calls for this. What this does is fund the Act, and the Act itself calls for communities before their particular facilities are funded to vote on the issue. So it's just a matter of timing at this point. Of course, there's no funding in the cultural facility fund, and some communities have gone ahead prior to it being funded. And even with the passage of this bill, and quite honestly, I'm not turf conscious. It would be those communities that are ready to go, that have passed it, that's where the funding would go. It wouldn't go into a community that hadn't had it before.
Mr. Chairman,
just briefly to add to that, it also requires, depending on size of the community, local match in there. It's in some cases 30%, between 10 and 30%, but it does take more than just the support of the people. They do have to involve themselves in giving toward this project, so it's not an out-and-out grant.
That's right, and I think it's very important, Senator, that you realize that in the enabling legislation that was passed in the 79 session, one of the requirements is that before any funds can be dispersed for the construction of these facilities is that the voters have to approve it in that community. It's a very good safeguard.
I get a little uncomfortable when you relate cultural facilities to economic development and quality of life. It seems like it's a mixed bag.
No, sir.
One of the purposes of funding cultural facilities is to increase economic development in the community. I don't know if that's really what we're trying to achieve.
Well, it will as a direct result. It's an inevitable thing, and it's a very important one. I don't see why there should be any confusion.
Of course, as it relates to the quality of life, that's where I'm waiting all day. In some cases, I'm not
compatible. I'm not sure I understand your point, sir.
Maybe I could help with that a little bit. I think young people and adults need something positive and constructive to do in the winter. And I think that athletics is one of those things, and most of the communities have gyms which support that kind of activity. Others of those things are public forums, plays, concerts, etc. And the facilities that we're proposing would increase the quality of life in that way.
What George is talking about is a more summertime thing where people who are traveling through the state will be able to participate in the kinds of activities that are generated there and thus bring their money to the community.
We're going to have to move right along. Do you have anyone else?
Yes.
Thank you.
Uh-oh. I'd like to introduce Mike Tavallaro from Saxman.
Hello, my name is Mike Tavallaro. I'm a member of the Cultural Facilities Development Committee and a representative of the City of Saxman. I won't reiterate any of the topic areas we've covered already. What I'd like to emphasize is the need to utilize Alaska's greatest renewable resource, its people. If we don't take that into account now, we're going to be facing some problems in the long run. We have people that we have to utilize at this point. One of the important factors through the utilization of our human renewable resource is the utilization of an established and recognized grassroots movement. Yet over the several years, the Cultural Facilities Development Committee has acted as a grassroots movement. It has clearly demonstrated the necessary elements of community participation through advocating this program. The program directly has received in substantial funding from the legislature. Now, we're talking about the program. We're not talking about individual projects. This program is administered through the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. They have their own guidelines and their own requirements for funding. Okay. In fact, as a grassroots organization representing the broad-based public sector, this program has received little of any recognition. The fact that $28 million was appropriated last year indirectly and not directly into the program begs the question as to whether or not our committee is a grassroots organization which uses community participation as a catalyst for community development, or merely a token group. Gentlemen, and I mean this with the greatest amount of respect. Your role is to improve the quality of life, and I know you hear that constantly, but I must remind you that the residents of this state require that the quality of life is improved, not the quantity. And I feel that's a very important aspect. Are there any questions?
Very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, we have one more speaker. Do you suppose we
could have to be very fast? The senators have to be on the floor. And...
Jane Stewart from Juneau.
Jane Stewart, I'm a member of the CFDC. This project since 1974. I live in Juneau, but I'm speaking as a person. I've lived here since 19, as a private person, lived here since 1945. I have grown children in Alaska, I have grandchildren in Alaska, and I've been waiting a long time for arts to have its day. Also, I came from Tulsa where I saw the dramatic impact of the oil money in a community. The campus is built by the oil companies, and they have a strong record of supporting the arts. And so I think it's reasonable to use the oil money in Alaska to support the arts.
We want to thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. We're going to have to get right down. Thanks, Jim.
Meeting will please come to order. First bill, the bill we'll take up this morning is a sponsored substitute for Senate Bill number 36. Senator Stimson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
36?
Senate Bill 36.
Oh, okay.
It's actually a sponsored substitute for Senate Bill 36 that is before us now. And this is a bill that creates a Citizens Advisory Commission for the federal management areas in Alaska. And the concept is one of creating a commission that would spend time reviewing what the federal regulations and guidelines are on the federal lands and the effect that it has on the surrounding private properties. And there have been some examples of abuses that have taken place Excuse me just a minute. In reviewing this, I had some real reservations about the whole concept, and so I held a subcommittee meeting to go over sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 36, and Senator Fahrenkamp was gracious enough to accommodate me and brought in some folks from Skagway, the mayor and members of the city council and other concerned citizens, and we spent quite a bit of time talking about the kind of problems that can develop when federal parklands move into an area and begin to impact the surrounding community and the private property owners and so forth. And I begin to see the value in the concept of this type of commission in terms of providing an awareness and understanding of just what federal regulations were being implemented and providing the state with some understanding of what was taking place. And this, I might just ask Senator Fahrenkamp if she would come before us and describe the composition of the commission and how she sees it functioning what the value of this commission would be as far as she's concerned.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the composition of this committee has given us a great deal of, we've given it a great deal of thought. In Resources Committee and other committees that viewed this bill, we've had many comments concerning the composition, wanting to put fewer appointments from the governor's office and more of the appointments coming from other areas of the community. In checking with the governor's office and with legal and others, we felt advisable to retain the 8 members coming from the governor's office. And the reason for that is with the intent of the legislation, we feel that we can have people there who are really interested, and these people will form subcommittees or subgroups around these 31 areas that will be impacted under the Alaska Lands Bill. We feel it's essential as this period of transition starts between the time that the federal government starts to really manage our lands and that the regulations that are not now firm regulations, but are in a, you know, we are in freeze pattern on that. But those that are proposed to govern the lands now will need to be watched very closely. It's my feeling that, and I didn't get interested in this at all until I was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming for the Western States Conference last summer. And when I saw that Jackson Hole is being asked to move their airport within the next 9 years because it's too close to the park and the noise pollution ruins the park. And this type of action on part of the federal government really got me interested in what were we going to do with 31 areas and 5 different agencies operating within the state of Alaska. Now, within the Alaska Lands Bill, there is a council, but this council is made up of bureaucrats. While the commission we propose here, we have no legal standing in law. It can work as a defusing unit, working both from both sides of the fence in order to keep the transition smoother. It also can recommend to the lieutenant governor and the attorney, to the attorney general, when they feel that the Park Service or BLM or any other federal agency is overstepping their legal authority in their actions within, near these parks. Some of the horror stories that we've had, some of the films, there was a 60-minute, one-hour program done nationwide on, it's not just Alaska, you know, on what's happening in every state. And we felt that we need to hire, through this commission, the expertise to know how far federal agencies can legally go without overstepping their bounds of authority. We also felt, I'm against too many commissions around. I think we have enough. And yet, here's an instance where I feel it's imperative that as we begin this transition, we have some people there to help our people know that someone cares. They'll work between the council, the state agencies, and the Attorney General's office, and they have a sunset date of 88 in case we find it isn't working for Alaska, that the problems are too large for a commission of this type, then it will automatically sunset unless we redo the bill. I'd be happy, you know, we've sent so much information to you. I don't want to be repetitive and take your time, but I'll be happy to answer any questions you do have.
Question? Betty, I don't know why. I don't know just how to ask the question, but under the D2 provisions that we've just had, the council, federal and state lands, I read that and thought that that had been put together, particularly if I thought if we got off in the beginning and appointed some state people on there to kind of get to help hire the staff and stuff, that we probably could be pretty effective in the use of that council. I guess my question is it seems like everybody wants to get into this business right now. Federal and state got together and put up the council to do this. There's an awful lot of stuff in Title 38 and other things, you know, that's supposed to work. I guess the question would be, do you feel that there's a possibility that what's this going to cost? Quarter of a million a year? Yeah, more than a half a million a year. I just want to make sure that we're not overreacting. I know how you feel and how all of us feel about some of the horror stories that you're talking about. And sometimes I'm beginning to believe that I'd just like to know is this your answer to the thing, or do you think that without this, the D2 council would not
move sufficient? Mr. Chairman, I feel that the D2 council is, or the Alaska Lands Council, is an essential part, and I think it has a very definite role to play, and I think we're very fortunate to have it. I also think that this commission is needed along with it. And the reason for that is that the council is made up mostly of bureaucrats. In fact, in all bureaucrats. There's, in this area now, especially in my country, there's a lot of distrust for bureaucrats at the present. And I feel that the people of the state need somebody they do feel like is on their side. And I think an example of that is the habitat regulations that are coming out right now. I just think it's essential that we have a defusing agent. Now, I had some difficulties explaining this to some members of the third floor in that their feeling was, you know, we didn't need it. But after our conversation, they can certainly see the need. And I wanted to have it sufficient to say a defusing agent. But as you know, there's a lot of apprehension, a lot of preparation that's frightening going on in many areas of this state right now. And I think this will keep us from going into a situation where people will take action that will cause major legal problems and cause some of our citizens to be hurt, in jail, everything else, if we don't have a place they feel they can go that's looking out for them. And many people who really don't know, who, you know, if it's one person in the park and they say to you, well, if you build that fence around your garden spot, we'll just condemn your land and take it. Many people don't know whether they can do that or they can't do that. And if they can go to somebody and talk about it and find out whether they do have any rights or don't, it's going to save us a lot of time, a lot of trouble, and a lot of money.
That is, if I continue, if there's nobody, I wanted to ask, maybe in my looking at the bill, I don't find any teeth in it. More or less a forum, another forum where people express their ideas and opinions. How do you see them? There's no no teeth in the bill, it's just kind of...
No, they have no legal status. The teeth comes from the fact that the state is interested enough to have people here, and it's amazing to me that in the one commission that's working with the park that's worked like this, the results that's come just from having a committee, in that they've gone from a trouble area to a cooperative area. The actions that were taking place in Skagway, just the mere introduction of this bill has been affected in helping to relieve some of their problems. And it's amazing, Mr. Chairman, how much people who know what they're talking about and who'll do the research, we're working mostly with reasonable men, and we show them where they're wrong, or they show this group where they're wrong, then the people, you know, where they're wrong, then it is a great arbitration agent. And it's worked very well in another state in our union. I think it's worth a try, Mr. Chairman, because I think we've just seen the tip of the iceberg of the problems that we will be having in the next 5 or 6 years.
Well, I think you're correct. I think there is a lot of public input. I guess we all make sure that we don't create, you know, once a person gets assigned to this commission, they become a bureaucrat. Everybody that works for the government or is part of something seems to be a bureaucrat. And I know exactly what you're saying, though. Everything seems to be made up of commissioners.
The only teeth they have is the rapport they have with the state agencies as well as the Attorney General's office in trying to furnish the expertise needed. Now, if the cuts that are going in, too, with legal services, you know, in our block grants that were discussed yesterday, if this happens to be one that we do not fund, and I don't know what we'll do about that, that's going to be up mostly to this group, but if that's one of the cuts there, where do people have to go?
Wait a minute, what was the part that you said, if what is one of the cuts?
Well, if legal services, which we have now, which people who cannot afford court cases, and many of these things wind up in court, if those things happen and we do cut or trim down legal services area, where do these people have to go? And in this way, they have the backing of the state if they've been wronged.
Money to fund the legal services.
That's true, you could do. I doubt if we have too many experts on federal regulatory law and legal services.
Any questions from any of the members? Betty, thank you very much.
Thank you for hearing the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Be the intent of the chair to hold this bill tomorrow. Check or two. If he doesn't, I'd like to.
Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, I hope we are considering the amendments that were considered by the Senate Resources Committee. They do change the duties in their number of major cleanup things. Is that correct, Senator Stimson?
And my understanding is that the bill before us is sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 36 with the amendments from the Senate Resources Committee.
Mr. Chairman, those amendments did a number of things, like taking away the $50 rate a day, and it's just straight per diem. Quite a change in clarification in the duties of the commission, and I think were positive additions to the bill.
There's no objections to the committee. We'll bring it up. Anything else to come before the committee? Not.
First item this morning, we'll sign some bills. SCR 18, requesting the governor to propose social services programs and submit recommended budget. Signed up by Senator Stimson. Senate Bill 127, an act making a special appropriation for a grant to the Interior Village Association. Signed that to Senator Sackett. Senate Bill 261, an act making a special appropriation to the Department of Community and Regional Affairs for research and analysis of the relocation of World War II. Sign that to myself. Senate Bill 282, an act relating to the legal rights of interest, Senator Sturgeon-Luskin. Senate Bill 322, an act making supplemental appropriation to pay miscellaneous claims against the state, Senator Sackett. First item that we'll pick up this morning is the Senate Bill 36, which we held over from yesterday's meeting. Robin, have you had a chance to go over the Finance Committee substitute?
No. But I did speak with the draft.
In your folder, there should be a copy of the committee substitute for sponsor substitutes for Senate Bill 36, Finance Committee. 36. PSSS SB 36, Finance.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dankler.
I'd ask that this bill be held over one day for two reasons. One is that I wanted to do a little checking to see how much I thought this might be necessary in light of the D2 Council that would be doing a lot of the same things. And secondly, of course, to come up with a committee substitute to include those amendments which were there. While I'm not going to by any means carry this bill as far as defending the amendments that are in it, I do think that the amendments make it a much better bill. I would, while I still have some problems with personally with this amount of money, the commission, setting up another commission. Mainly, I don't have any problem with the commission, but it's a problem that it doesn't have enough teeth. I like what it's going to do, but I wish it had a little more power. But if, and I'd be glad to withdraw this motion if someone wants to discuss it further. If there's not any further discussion on it, I see Senator Sturgeon-Luskin might. I was going to move the bill. But
Mr. Chairman, I have absolutely no problem. The only thing I would like to know is what we have here just reflects the changes that we acted on in Senate resources. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. No problem.
Then, with that, I'd move the bill on individual recommendations, Mr. Chairman.
Hearing no objections, committee substitute for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 36, Finance and Resource Committee's individual recommendations.
They didn't handle that. You passed it out with amendments. Not, it wasn't.
So we're just taking their amendments and made a Finance Committee substitute.
The next item that we're going to take up is Senate Concurrent Resolution 9.
Mr. Chairman, we have Guy Van Dorn today to talk about this.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm here at the request of Representative Brian Rogers, who is chairman of the Constitutional Convention, Joint Constitutional Convention Committee, and who was unable to be here this morning. In your packets, I believe, you have a memo that was written to Senator Rohde when this resolution was before the Judiciary Committee. It kind of gives a background of the calling of the Constitutional Convention, the events leading up to 1970, 1972, and the formation of this committee during the interim of 1979, the work that was accomplished at that time, the work that was accomplished in 1980. I have also handed out to you a booklet that has the transcripts of the meetings that were held outside with recognized constitutional experts throughout the United States. The booklet contains the edited transcripts and also a summary form of each of the meetings. one of the most important things that came out from the meeting, from all of the people that have had anything to do with constitutional conventions, constitutional revision, or constitutional issues, they stressed pre-planning and preparation. Of course, we do not know until 1982 in November whether we will have a constitutional convention or not. However, all of the work that has been accomplished thus far by the committee and work that will be accomplished in the future should the committee continue to exist will be applicable for any future constitutional convention. There has never been any planning done prior to the formation of this committee in the last 2 years. And we're hoping that whatever staff develops and whatever is written will be applicable in the future. For your information, we have let a contract out to write a citizen's guide to the Constitutional Convention, which of course will be useful not only for legislators, for state people, but also for teachers and university people. It'll be a simplified form and, as it says, a citizen's guide to the Constitution. We also are preparing a brochure that will explain the Constitution, constitutional conventions, what they accomplish, what they should accomplish, in order for public information prior to the 1982 vote. Also, in your pamphlet, you should have a schedule of the activities that are perceived to be undertaken by the committee for this session, for interims 81, for 1982, and interim 82 leading up to the vote on the Constitutional Convention. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Van Doren, you don't list the membership, or am I missing something of the committee?
The membership of the committee is to be consisting of 3 members from the House, 3 members from the Senate, an appointee by...
I see. I missed it there. It's listed plus the 3 additional, then the from the court, the lieutenant governor, and additional person by the governor.
Yes, it was felt that because of the importance of a constitutional convention and the fact that all branches of government would be affected, that there should be membership from each of the other branches.
Senator Dacre?
On the fiscal note, do you have a copy of that?
Pardon me?
Do you have a copy of the fiscal
note? I know what the fiscal note includes.
It says 81, 96,000, 10,000 in travel. How would you anticipate using that much travel?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dankworth, the travel would be, is to be used for the public hearings that will be held throughout the state during the interim period of time for members of the committee. What we're doing is, we're calling them public hearings. They're actually public hearings and informational sessions. And what we hope to do is to meet in 10 or 15 communities throughout the state, identify the issues that the people have that they would like to see addressed if there is a constitutional convention, and also disseminate information to the people on what the committee is, constitutional information, constitutional convention information. And this was a rough figure based on X amount of people traveling to X amount of cities during the interim period.
All these people are on board now.
Pardon me?
Are these people working now?
No, sir. The committee in effect dissolved at the beginning of this session, although the people are still doing, I'm still doing some work with the committee just as a side, some side work, and these would be have to be reappointed by the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House and also the other branches of government as soon as the bill has been passed to the resolution.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir?
I'd like some comment. To me, there's one thing to anticipate some structural problems and so on. It seems like there's quite another to go whipping around the state in a whole bunch of public meetings. In a sense, I don't know if we're just by the very fact that you're there and the issues get a lot of attention and people make a decision maybe that those can't be handled. Are we, in fact, going out pre to the voters getting ourselves all whipped up to go and vote yes. I happen to be one who's not at all convinced there should be a constitutional planning. Quite a convention. There's quite a different thing between the structural issues to see that that is expedited if the voters say yes. The other issue being, what are you doing when you're going out? Are we putting the role of six legislators and these other people to go out and whet the appetite of the public to get into the question of subsistence, of abortion, of capital move, of difficult issues by some kind of legislative action? I'm frankly nervous about it.
Well, I have to agree with what Senator Sturgill-Lewski is. I mean, secondly, of course, I am very concerned with interim committees, period. And being careful, I think, if all the criticism we get sometimes, I want to make sure they're worthwhile, they're needed, and they're funded. And like the guy and yourself, you work for the legislature, then you become administrative assistant for 7 months after the legislature goes on. And I don't know who the other people are, but I just want to make sure we don't just set up committees. And I think we all agree, you may agree with us, but I don't like to see interim committees set up for the purpose of keeping interim or legislative staff working if that's the only person. So, I don't know, it seems like $10,000 worth of travel and stuff like that is a little too much based on what Senator Sturgill-Lewski said. Has the council the fiscal note was prepared by you, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it was, at the request of Representative Rogers.
Where does all this take place? Where's the headquarters of this, in Fairbanks?
No, we have been headquartering this in, as far as my work has been concerned, and the staff work of the committee, the majority of it has taken place in Juneau. Some of the research that we've undertaken with the archives that the university has of the original Constitutional Convention, the work has been conducted in Fairbanks at the university in their record library of the original Constitutional Convention.
Yes, but did we have staff on in Fairbanks this summer on this convention?
We had only part-time for approximately 3 weeks. And they were researching into the archives of the university and the records of the Constitutional Convention, the original one.
Hey, where do you anticipate these people will be if this is approved? Where will they be as staff?
I would assume, if I am the one that has chosen staff, again, I would assume that we would be working out of Juneau. We do have access to the archives here. We have office space typing and that sort of thing. Totally set up. I would assume that it would be here. If the chairman or if the committee decides to choose staff from Fairbanks or some other area of the state, then I imagine that's where the headquarters of the staff would be.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator?
Direct you to, if I might, to, or I would appreciate your taking a look at page 4. Talks about some issues that have received earlier consideration, election of judges, attorney generals, etc. Then new issues, right to live, capital move, land distribution, limitation on taxes and expenditures. All those are really important issues that are addressed by the legislature or not addressed in a number of ways. But under the charges of the committee, one at the bottom, it says, assure that the public will be given a chance to express their feelings on the above and other issues, will be informed on the pros and cons of calling a convention, and will be apprised of alternate methods of achieving the goals. I really feel that we are intervening, if you will, in a matter here. It's bound to have, depending on the constituency of the committee, the whole staff, have an impact on whether or not that convention is called. And I guess that bothers me. It would bother me if I were a member of that committee and going around doing the public hearing. Certainly, the idea of the staff work that's been done, I think, is very interesting. It's been done to date. I can certainly see a kind of voter's guide thing to 2 and 3. But where we have a voter's pamphlet, for instance, we have a very carefully pro and con statute. It's handled through the Lieutenant Governor's office. And here, I just see such a potential, if you will, for either whetting appetites, giving information that's slanted in one direction or another. And it just doesn't seem like really an appropriate role, that number one, to go out.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond just to one thing that has been brought up about this before, is the committee instructed me on drafting the brochure to be very, very careful about expressing an opinion one way or another about the Constitutional Convention. The pamphlet itself is intended to be based similar to a pamphlet that was put out by the state of Hawaii prior to their vote on the Constitutional Convention, and basically only state what the Constitution is, what the laws in the Constitution are, how they may be changed, and the basic idea of what a constitutional is and what it is not, recognizing, we would recognize that there are many things that would be handled by legislation that should not be written into the basic fundamental law of the state as the Constitution and would appear by statutes. There are a lot of people out there who do not realize that many of these issues that Senator Sergielewski was talking about should be addressed properly by statute rather than Constitution. I think there's a lot of people that don't understand the difference of setting up the fundamental law of the land as opposed to the statute law of the land. And this is one of the things that we would try to get across, is the fact that there are other methods of handling issues rather than Constitutional Convention.
Mr. Chairman, Guy, I really agree with the points Senator Sturgelewski is raising, and it seems to me like the approach, and I know this is just one aspect of what you're involved in, but the approach used here could generate some unrealistic or at least very arbitrary kind of reactions to issues. I mean, I could see where an individual might identify with a particular issue and feel like the best way to resolve that would be to have a constitutional convention. And I know it's kind of a mixed bag, because on the one hand, we don't want to be promoting the fact that we don't want our electorate well informed. But at the same time, I think there's a delicate balance there. I happen to be one that isn't at all excited about having a constitutional convention. And I think it's a very delicate balance there between providing people with information and slanting, or at least, you know, tipping the scales so that folks are more inclined to go one way or the other. And the approach that you're using here, just from my perspective looking at this, I would be inclined to think it would tip the scales towards people thinking, yeah, we ought to have a constitutional convention. And I guess I see a lot of merit in what you're attempting to do in preparation for a convention if it's necessary. I'm not sure that it's necessary to do a lot of these other things. And I guess that would be my my reaction to the proposal, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, of course, that works two ways. Obviously, there are going to be interest groups who are going to go out and pursue having a constitutional convention. So it seems to me that, well, as elected officials, we should do all we can to inform the public on both sides of the issue, because you're going to have people out there wondering what's going on. And some of these issues that they're going to address have been before this body for the 12 years that I've been here, and through some politically maneuver, we've never been able to get them before the people themselves. And I think it's very important that people be allowed to break into our club and to be expressed and know their opinions. And I think it's one of the chances we're going to have to take. I think that ultimately the wisdom of the people are going to prevail.
Mr. Chairman, I really agree, Dick, and I think we're saying the same thing. But I look at, let's just take an issue like the capital move. You know, that I could just see something like that being so distorted and confused that a lot of folks that are so emotionally into that issue would say, well, here's a way we could really deal with that. Let's have a constitutional convention. You know? And it isn't long before the merits of the question of a convention are lost and the emotion of a particular issue or what they're caught up in. I guess that's all I'm saying is it seems to me like we've got to be kind of careful about the approach that's used in trying to inform people so that we don't generate a lot of unnecessary excitement. Thank you, Mr. Nickler.
Well, of course, I don't make any bones about it. I'm opposed to this, so my comments will have to go along that way. I never liked it to begin with, and I don't like the way it was structured, so you'll have to take my comments along those lines. But, it's another one of those things that will set up some more people to study things that I don't think the point that's already been made here is that this thing gets out there aside from, we get up to our rear ends and alligators before we remember our job was to drain the pond in most of these studies. And I'll hush.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Driscoll?
Just say where I am. I could support an interim committee if there were more clearly defined the task. For instance, I could not support item one unless I really had some explanation that would get over some pretty strong feelings. Item two and three, where you're talking more of a staff level, an information to, if it should pass to people about, or, just technical information on how a constitutional convention is structured, that kind of thing, I think is could well be appropriate. But the idea of holding public hearings to get into these issues is going to raise perceptions on one side or the other. And I think it's an inappropriate forum, and I feel pretty strongly. I'd like to hear the Representative Rogers to speak on the charge to the committee prior to taking action, or I will have to suggest do not vote.
I'd like to make a motion that we hold this bill for further consideration.
Hearing no objection.
So moved. Your turn to the bill file for further study. Next item on the agenda, Senate Bill 214. Jared, want to come up? Do you want to testify, or do you just want to watch? Or? Bill before us, 214, is an act making supplemental appropriation for the Department of Commerce and Economic Development for a mining loan fund. Basically, in the budget last year, there was $10 million allocated. At this point, something close to $9 million already committed, and there's something over $4 million in advance of loans that have been applied for. Do either of you want to add anything to this? Or?
Mr. Chairman, no, that's basically what I came for, was to bring you the up-to-date figures. We have $944,000 left in the fund right now and have $4,134,000 in applications on hand.
Mr. Chair.
Sir
Deckard. I don't know why it seems like sometimes I don't understand these well enough, but what kind of loans, what kind of programs are we talking about and what size loans are being made? Can you answer those questions? Is that an unfair question? Do you
think? No, that's fair.
I just want to know who's borrowing this money for what and how do they pay it back? And I'm just not up on the program, and I'd like to know a little more before we put $10 million more into it.
Most of the loans we've been making, and so far we've only made 9 loans. Most of them have been the smaller ones, $50,000 up to $200,000.
mostly buying equipment, providing some working capital, primarily for placer mining operations. There is one large loan, as you can tell by the number of loans, nine, that was to use a belly coal mine.
To the use of belly coal mine, and that was for equipment or operating? You don't loan money on operating, or is it just...
Yes, we can for operating, but this one was for equipment.
And what percent do we loan that at?
That's 10%.
10%, and is that long-term money, or...?
Yes, they can go up to 15 years.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Zelensky?
You have a loan maximum of $5 million. What was the usability amount?
4.6.
4.6. Is the program adequately structured really to handle the requests that come to you?
So far, yes.
You're not getting... Are you getting large outside firms coming in that are looking to that money? Who are you? Do you see this changing and getting into a lot of the smaller, say, placer mine operations? What's going to happen as you get more money and people become more familiar with this program?
Right now it's the smaller operations, but perhaps Mr. Sims, who works more closely with it, would be able to help us.
I think there have been certain criticisms and misconceptions by elements of the placer mining industry concerning the loan program. I had a meeting with the local board in Fairbanks recently and suggested that the program could be improved substantially if they would make aware to us some of the problems that they might perceive. One suggestion that I'm currently making is that this is an initiative from my own office, that perhaps the mining loans should be regarded in somewhat similar light to agricultural loans and fishing loans, recognizing that placer mining is a seasonal activity. At the moment, the loans are being written and closed with the proviso that interest is payable virtually from the date of closing on a monthly basis. And one, I think, positive suggestion that would address certainly one of the concerns of the miners would be to recognize the seasonal aspect and provide for interest to be repaid on at least an annual type basis. This is something which might come through. In terms of the number of loan requests, we have something like 300 packages out, 300 inquiries through the office. There haven't been all that many proposals submitted to us. But I think it is a young program, and it's a program which is tending to catch on.
Two questions. One is, why did like the Yusuf Valley loan for $4.5 million, would that work in the ADA program, last Industrial Development Authority? Is it just the interest rate of why we had to have a separate loan program for that? The reason why he couldn't have gone to the Alaska Industrial Development Authority and got the same loan?
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Dankworth, he could have. I think that we predated ADA being active. Our program was active first, and he was one of the first ones in. So I think he was acting fast and getting the money where it was available. Now, yes, the type of equipment he bought would be available through an ADA loan.
The reason I'm asking these questions, of course, we're all concerned with everybody's got a different loan, one for the fisherman, one for agriculture, one for mining, one for the businessman. And I was asking if the $4.5 million of the $5 million loan could have been done through ADA, if the loan program. Now, apparently the smaller ones would have more difficulty in going through ADA program or something like that. Which gets me back to a point that Alaska Industrial Authority and its original purpose was for the types of claims, you know, large amounts to bond the money and take the funds. But apparently one company came in and got a pretty sizable portion of the $4.5 million. And I guess out of the nine loans, how many people are hired to administer those nine loans? How many people are charged off for the purpose of administering the nine loans? full-time jobs that are charged off to this program.
At this point, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, at this point, nobody is assigned to this program wholly. When it was thrown into Senate Bill 1 last year, we lost the fiscal note that went with it, so that we actually gained no one for the mining program. It happened to work out well because we picked up Don Hoover from Economic Enterprise, and he had experience in this line. So we have one person who works mining loans, but that's not his entire job.
You didn't add extra staff to make these nine?
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman? Oh, excuse me.
Question?
Chairman, you mentioned that to put this program like the fisheries loan programs. As I recall, the fisheries loan programs are not in the Department of Commerce. They're being phased out. So we've gone from a 10% or what was the interest rate?
9.5%
to a what?
Depends on where they go. It's about 12 at ADA and 15 at CFAM.
Are you suggesting then that we do that with the mining funds?
No, I think I was merely suggesting that mining is a seasonal, or could be regarded legitimately, particularly placer mining, as a seasonal activity, and that the income derived from placer mining is of a seasonal nature. And rather than the expectancy that the placer miner, right from the closing of his loan, be responsible for interest payments as of month one, that those interest payments should be accumulated, and he should have perhaps the latitude to pay on a monthly basis or quarterly basis or a yearly basis, but no, certainly no longer than that.
Chairman, how many programs do you administer without in your department?
13.
13. Large programs are 10% of that?
As far as the total amount to be loaned, this is the largest one. We're losing tourism, which was the next largest.
Where's that going?
ADA.
So you're trying to go there.
Probably close to 12.
Any other questions? Senator Simpson?
You
have.
Okay. Mr. Sims? You made reference to the structure of those loans and the fact that the mining loan should really be designed as a seasonal loan. What needs to be done to accomplish that? Does that require legislation?
We were discussing that this morning, and probably the feeling is not.
I think we could do it with regulation. It would be not directly following the statute, but I think that we could word it correctly to come out doing it by regulation.
I'm just curious about, is this the first that you've considered that? I mean, it would seem to me like with this type of loan, you would have given this some thought and already be exploring the feasibility of establishing regulations that would allow you to approach it that way.
If I may? Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sims came on with us recently as the Director of Mineral Development, so the program was running in Division of Business Loans before Mr. Sims came on, so his suggestions are new to us.
I might object. This is the first year, actually, of the program. It's just started. It's so successful as a purpose of this supplemental, and that people are getting ready to go mining. The season starts, of course, April.
Mr. Chairman, I'm prepared to support the thing today, but I do have a question. I think that one of the things that, let's say, Budget and Audit is looking at is the multiplicity of loans and whether things can be accomplished. When this was set up, it was to meet a need, and of course, ADA was not there. I'm wondering, we need, I think, to explore whether ADA could accomplish it, but the loans that are being made are strictly on the basis of credit and collateral, and they're good loans. Are they the kind of loans that, if the banks were so inclined or so on, they're marketable loans, are they, other than the interest rate? In other words, they're good, solid loans.
That is
the state's going to get its money back. It's going to have what kind of a delinquency rate? Would you anticipate like housing loans or something else? What might it be?
I would anticipate no more than 4% on them. I don't think we're going to have
difficulty. Well, that's high, though. That's a bit high, isn't it?
Not by the past record in business loans.
You'd say that it would equate then with the normal business loan that you might.
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, what about the $10 million figure? It sounded like the estimates you had put you at about $5 million now or something like that. You project that you'll need another $5 million during the... This money would become immediately available. So you need another $10 million for fiscal year 81?
Mr. Chairman, right now we know that we need another $4 million. It's gaining popularity. The program is gaining popularity. We haven't even, for instance, tapped Southeast. We know there are applications coming in from Southeast, and haven't processed any. It's very conceivable we could use that amount of money before the end of the year.
If I might, and I take the liberty, and it was my bill, as a result of meeting with the Miners Association up in the interior, at which time they stressed that the fund was out of money. Consequently, because it was common knowledge amongst the miners that it was out of money, there was many miners who said, why apply? It's very lengthy, a solid loan. They have to go through all the paperwork. So, consequently, there's many people who will apply the moment they hear there is money available.
Chairman, when I was talking about commercial fishing loans or the other types of tourism loans, I think we might have made a mistake last year by putting these programs out into a state-run corporation. I think that we're creating a burden on the people who are borrowing the money. We're feeding the fires of inflation, obviously. And I would hope that at least to be able to keep the mining loans in the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. I think it's the shortest the way to do it. They're good, solid loans. I don't know why we deviated from that process originally. I think that we probably made a mistake and probably suffered for many years because we did last year.
Is there any more questions from the committee? Hear a motion?
Chairman, I would move that we pass out of committee with individual recommendation Senate Bill number 214. I'll be doing that.
Without objection, 214 passed out of committee with individual recommendations. Any member of the committee have anything they'd like to bring before the committee at this time?
Mr. Chairman, just what is our schedule? We're meeting tomorrow. Are we with the Board of Regents on the university budget?
I hope so. I've got to meet with the president of the university probably around lunchtime.
Okay.
I don't know what their schedule is. They currently are
with the
Regents right now. So.
And we have no bill calendar, do we, until right now?
No.
Fine.
Kind of just hanging loose until we find out what their schedule is and what they're going to come
Fine.
Up with.
Thank you.
Nothing further, committee? Chair.